May it please the Court. This is a case of discrimination by sex or based on sex, hostile work environment, and retaliation. And in this case, the defendant misled the district court into saying that discrimination could be proved by one of two ways, through the direct or indirect method. As Judge Capalla has pointed out, the law has changed, and now we use the straightforward totality approach, which is consistent with the history of this court in recognizing, for instance, in Troop versus May, that direct or circumstantial evidence, or both, may be used, consistent with Sample versus Walgreen, which this court said that direct or indirect approach or combined approaches may be used. And so this approach is also consistent with Seventh Circuit Forum Instruction 1.12, stating that all evidence must be considered both direct and circumstantial, that there is no difference in the weight, and that all of the evidence must be considered. I have great sympathy for the district court judges and everyone, as a matter of fact, in trying to straighten out the law of discrimination. But this court has gone forward recently and making great progress in that area in the case of Hill versus Tangerlini, stating that the objections of self-serving testimony is not an objection, legal objection to the admissibility or consideration of evidence. And that case cited a long line of cases which had stated or implied something to the contrary. So we're now approaching the position and time of the law where we can say definitely that these old decisions, misleading the parties and the courts, the district courts in particular, to say, well, you have to have either one or the other, and which one are you following, that those decisions are just not correct. In this case, this is a case where the facts show the importance of the straightforward totality approach of not pigeonholing evidence, because it involves a hostile work environment, which the McDonnell Douglas case did not involve. And hostile work environment has all kinds of evidence, usually circumstantial evidence, and that's touching on direct evidence also, showing discrimination. And the courts, we parties in the district courts below, have struggled with what is direct and what is circumstantial. And these authorities that I've mentioned here show that it doesn't matter. All the evidence must be considered, so we don't pigeonhole.
Mr. Darst, could I ask you, on your hostile environment claim, could you make your best case for employer liability as opposed to just coworkers being mean to each other?
Your Honor, the Vance case addresses the situation here where the trainer is involved. And
he backed off, right? So
he to the great detriment of the plaintiff.
That's a different issue, but okay. But talk to me about employer liability. That's the law. There has to be a way to show it.
Right. Early on in his training, he made the sexual statements asking for a threesome with the plaintiff, which is very offensive. And then when she refused and said she wasn't interested and didn't want to hear those kinds of statements, didn't want to hear the statements about whether her nipples were hard from coming in from the cold and that kind of thing.
We're familiar with the evidence.
He then,
the employer liability.
He then refused to train her, which is serious, a serious adverse action. You can look at, not only does she testify that he refused to train her, it's supported by her training book, which they call a blue book, which has very little, very few initials or signatures of his, where he's supposed to be the trainer. And at the end of her probation, they couldn't even find her blue book, training book, and they had to come up with a book. And then her sergeant signed off because she said that she had trained herself. Her sergeant had observed that she was a good employee, and he signed, and that's Sergeant Dinkins.
Well, but didn't she receive? Is there? Do you still contest that she didn't receive all the probationary training that she was entitled to?
We do contest that. As a matter of fact, he refused to train her, as Judge Hamilton pointed out, very shortly after, immediately after she said she wasn't interested in a threesome. She didn't want to hear his talk about whether her nipples were hard from coming
in. But eventually, I thought she got all the training from Dinkins.
No. He was her sergeant. He signed off on her blue book, and he verified that she was trained. She testified she trained herself. The defendant has argued here in briefs that, and I believe the district court even said that Dinkins was removed as her trainer. He was not removed. Van Dyne was removed as her trainer. He was not removed. He continued to be her trainer. As a matter of fact, he testified in the portions of his testimony in the appendix that even when she was sent to other areas, they would send him back to her and say that she was not properly trained. Well, she was getting trained as fast as she could when she would arrive at an area, but when she would first be arrive at the area, she was not trained. She would make some mistakes or follow the instructions of a more senior officer, and then she would be reprimanded along with the senior officer when she would open a door that senior officer would tell her to open. So she was not trained. She was never trained by anyone except herself. Dinkins was friendly to her and did see that she was a good worker, but he was not a training officer and did not train her. He just signed off. And you can see that he's signing off on the blue book. I think it's most of his initials are the same date or grouped into dates. So that is, thank you for asking. So after that then, Van Dyne, the trainer, refused to train her, but he then would harass her and say, do your job, do your effing job, and would give her a hard time about doing the job. So he wouldn't train her, but he would harass her, and he harassed her constantly. Then other employees...
Is it correct that her first complaint about Van Dyne was made some 6-7 months after he was this very brief period of training?
That was the first written complaint that she made. Before that, she complained to Van Dyne that she did
is
not...
Is there any evidence that she complained to a supervisor before that summer of the following year?
Yes, there is. She complained verbally. And
where do
we
have that in the record?
That is in the brief, I believe, and it is cited to her testimony. She was told to go to, I believe it was Internal Affairs, Mr. Rainey, and Mr. Rainey avoided her and would not talk to her about it. But regardless of who she complained to before, she definitely complained to Van Dyne. Then she was complaining orally. And then in April of 2010, she complained about another officer who was asking an offender to ask her if she shaved under her armpits and in her pubic area, which is highly offensive, especially in a correctional institution where you're dealing with offenders. You don't say that staff to staff. You certainly don't tell offenders to go up and ask a female.
And that was a coworker, right? She complained.
That's correct.
And how did management respond?
Management did not take any action that we know of and has not offered any evidence.
I thought there was no further problem.
He didn't make that statement anymore, but then the harassment went from person to person to person, and it got all through the institution, where she was called a snitch because she had complained. She was called bitch, whore. She was called, and Van Dyne testified to this, his deposition where he said, well, no, I didn't do much, although he had admitted to the institution that he made sexual statements routinely, but only to those who were receptive, he said. He was saying, I didn't make statements, but I heard other statements made. So he was testifying that other people called her bitch, whore, things like that, including crazy old French bitch, which pretty well sums up the attitude of the employees against her after she had made written complaints, as the district court noted, numerous complaints, numerous complaints about the harassment and discrimination. And then what did the institution do? The institution, in writing, only gave him a written reprimand, but for the victim, gave her the same severity, gave her a written reprimand for what? Threatening to complain about sexual harassment. It's in writing, and I believe it's Appendix 29. And also threw in there that she'd called people stupid Americans, which no one testified to. We interviewed or deposed the female, Jessica Hammond, Hammock, who was cited in the write-up, and she said, no, I never heard any such statement. Van Dyne, then,'s testimony was contrary to the stupid American statement. He changed and said that she called someone an American pig or American capitalist or something. He couldn't even get his own story straight. But it's obvious that he made it up in order to retaliate against the female who had complained. So with all of this atmosphere against her at the institution, then, of course, it's not surprising that she was sexually assaulted by another offender. I mean, when you ask offenders to go up and ask a female if she shaves her armpits and pubic area, it's not going to surprising that an offender is going to grab her butt, and she then testified that his fingers were even in her vagina through her pants, and then they didn't do anything to him except find him making a signal, a sexual signal or something, instead of finding
but,
that.
But he never harassed her again.
He never harassed her again because she was unable to go back to work.
Well, but that's not the employer's fault.
Yes.
We know that according to her, he assaulted him. But then there was never any further problems with him. How can we say that the response of the employer wasn't sufficient?
Because the employer did not call her as a witness, which they usually do. The employer didn't.
But we're talking about the result. There was never any problem with him again. Why wasn't it sufficient? How can we say a reasonable trier of fact would say that it was insufficient?
Her doctor verified that she was on the verge of a nervous breakdown by this time. It was more than 2 years of this constant harassment.
And I'm talking about the inmate assault.
Yes. He was placed back in the general population where he was able to then attack her again or anyone else.
He never did.
Well, but the law says, or the decisions say, you can't just go from one to one to one, from one harasser to another harasser to another harasser. It became such a terrible situation here that everybody was against her, allowing her to be sexually assaulted. They didn't do anything to him to take him out of the general population, which is their normal procedure, except for 2 days pending his hearing. Then they put him right back in general population, where she would have had to have worked if she had gone back to work.
Mr. Darst, do you agree that there are different versions of that event, and the most serious description was the one first provided in her deposition?
That is correct.
That at the time she said that the offender had grabbed her buttocks.
Correct.
Okay.
I do. And she asked for assistance in writing out her her complaint. Because, as you can see, she writes and speaks with a French accent. And some of the employees would not assist her. Finally, she found someone who would assist her in writing out her complaint. So this was the same pattern over a long period of time that employees were not assisting her. They wouldn't tell her, for instance, the leave policy, and then they write her up for violating the leave policy. They wouldn't assist her with training, and then they write her up for not being trained. They'd call her these names. It was a long line of harassment. Now, the cases say that you can't just, well, Van Dyne can't harass her and then turn everyone against her and then say, well, Van Dyne's not harassing anymore. Actually, she testified that Van Dyne harassed her daily when she was with Van Dyne. And then when she left to go to other areas, they would send her back to Van Dyne. He testified to be retrained, and he never retrained her. This is one of the most serious cases of harassment and discrimination.
How many incidents of national origin are there in the record?
Pardon me?
How many incidents of national origin?
Well, I haven't counted the incidents, but the categories include, and this is another thing, the court cannot pigeonhole national origin harassment when it's connected to sexual harassment. When you've got people calling a female a crazy old French bitch, to separate out, well, here's this harassment over here, here's this harassment over here, and we're just going to look at this little bit here. The totality approach doesn't do that.
Well, what's your evidence. What's your authority for combining them?
Well, the Troop case says that the evidence can be considered together. The Simple case says that all approaches can be combined. And the evidence about the French reference is asking her if because she was French, she shaved her armpits and her pubic hair, statements that she was not American, statements to speak English, statements to go back to France, calling her an old French bitch. Those are the categories that I've written down. Thank you.
Mr. Steiner?
Yes. May it please the court. We believe the district court very properly looked at the actual evidence that was presented in this case and came to an appropriate decision. Regarding the claims of sex and national origin discrimination and the hostile work environment, there's a need in both of those situations to show employer liability. And that's one of the critical problems as properly identified by the district judge in this particular case. Because the evidence in this case was that when the employer was told about a problem, it did take some action, it did some investigation, and action was taken. The evidence is that after the investigation, at least the persons that were involved, which is sort of the usual kind of situation, did not in any way continue to make any kind of sexual or national origin kind of comments towards Ms. Shaib. What we really have, we start with this Officer Van Dyne, who's just a co-worker of...
He's a training officer.
She was...
It's an ambiguous situation.
It is ambiguous.
For a rookie, that may be pretty intimidating.
That I agree. And I would say this about the training officer. If Van Dyne served in part as her training officer to begin with, and she had problems with him, she should have told her supervisor or someone, in management about this and ask for a new trainer or just point out the problems that were occurring, if it was in November, December, January, when she was first there, and not wait until July, essentially long after most of these incidents had occurred with Van Dyne, to complain. So, that's part of the problem with this whole, lack of proof that there's some employer responsibility or liability in these particular situations.
Mr. Steiner, can I ask you about the transfer issue, about transferring from the main prison to the industrial facility? Help me with the paperwork here. Was there some kind of review of her application, right?
Yeah,
it was passed on to the warden.
The warden would probably be making a final decision.
Right, but there was some kind of panel that looked at her, and it's unclear to me whether they recommended her for transfer or said she was qualified.
As I understand the record, they indicated she was qualified to transfer, but then you have to make a final decision whether you're going to select her as opposed to other people.
Okay. Now, one of the concerns that I have with the state's position in this case, we've got this elaborate body of law about what's an adverse employment action for discrimination claims, adjust that a little bit for retaliation claims, and I understand that in general bad performance reviews and things like work improvement plans that don't actually change working conditions, we usually don't treat as adverse actions. But it looks like here, those were exactly the facts that were used to deny her transfer, or at least a jury could so find. And from that perspective, they look pretty adverse if this was a positive thing with the transfer.
Well, the district judge pointed out two things that I think were critical to the decision she made and are actually critical to the reason why this court ought to affirm. One of those was this transfer was entirely lateral in nature. And she's a correctional officer at the Pendleton Correctional Facility. She wants to go to the other facility that's next door to that facility. Both positions are just a correctional officer's position. No higher pay, no better
work. How about the difference between the farm at Terre Haute, as it's been known colloquially for decades, and the death row?
Well, the farm's actually Putnamville, but I know what you're talking
about. It's not the state. I'm talking about the federal.
Oh, the federal.
The state farm at Putnamville. I'm talking about the minimum security facility at Terre Haute.
Well, one thing is these facilities are much closer in kinds of facilities and kinds of people that are going to be housed there than those situations would be. And the kind of job she was doing was going to be very similar. You know, she's going to be supervising a certain number of offenders, probably about the same number during certain periods of time.
But I think Judge Hamilton's point is they're less serious offenders in the
like a farm setting or some kind of camp setting.
In the industrial facility here.
Yeah, but these two facilities are not that different.
How is that the kind of thing we can decide on summary judgment here?
Well, I think that what the district court judge looked at here, and I think what you can look at here is the fact that essentially it's just the same position. It's essentially a correctional officer position. The district judge made another observation, though, I think that is telling, and that is that it is a fact. It is an undisputed fact that she was put on a work improvement plan. And therefore, when she was applying to move from one facility to another, she was in the situation where she was on a work improvement plan. And so people are going to be aware of that.
Right.
That makes her a little bit different than the other people.
Sure. And her theory is that she was on a work improvement plan because of this campaign of harassment against her, and that it had that adverse effect against her. Let me just ask you, your brief quotes the specific findings of the investigation done after she first complained formally about Van Dyne. And to justify the reprimand of her, it says that she has threatened other coworkers to file sexual harassment charges found unwarranted. Now, it goes on to criticize her performance in a number of other ways. Isn't that protected conduct under the statute, because it's protected, I thought, as long as your complaint is in good faith and is reasonable?
Well, I think that we had the Department of Personnel, I think, actually did that investigation, not actually even the staff that was out at the prison. So they brought in some people who were somewhat independent of the entire situation. They talked to people about this. I think when you look at the overall statement that was made by the investigator in that situation, there was a determination that Ms. Shaib was doing some things that were somewhat similar to what she was accusing other people of doing. She was referring to her coworkers as being stupid. She was saying that they were referring to her as being incompetent. I think that you have to look at that overall. And while there may have been a mention of that kind of thing, because it probably was reported, people said, "Well, she threatened me in this way or that way." And by the way, it doesn't indicate it was just males that were talked to. Both male and female officers, I think, were ones that were involved in these kinds of situations where they didn't appear to get along with Ms. Shaib completely.
Well, if what we were dealing with was this kind of disciplinary action, it said, and by the way, she's black. That'd be a pretty bright red flag, right?
Well, it would be of some concern.
You'd wonder,
I'd say,
what on earth is that in there for, right?
That's right. But I would point out again, you know, when you're looking at this, this was an outside, essentially, investigator who came in and looked at this.
These are the personnel pros for the state of Indiana.
Well, that's
and
true.
And do they know what's protected conduct and what's not?
But that's true. They should. But I also think they were reporting what was told to them at the time. And it is not quite the same as saying...
You report that as a specific finding, that she has threatened other coworkers to file sexual harassment charges found unwarranted. And my concern, it's a subtle one, I admit. The difference between found unwarranted and made in bad faith is a critical one in retaliation law.
I understand your point, but I think that what we were looking at there on the whole is a situation where the investigator has just reported what was told to them and has determined that there was some conduct on the part of Ms. Shaib that warranted a reprimand. Because if she was calling her coworkers stupid and she was accusing them of doing the same thing, that's totally justified.
That's part of the same memo, I'll grant you. But you're describing these not as reports but as findings. After the investigation, by the pros who are supposed to know the difference between protected and unprotected conduct.
Well, I would say they were recommendations. They were a report and a recommendation that were made by the personnel people to the people at the correctional facility, because those are the people that had to decide ultimately whether to actually act on the recommendation, which was to reprimand Ms. Shaib for what was said or what she had said. And that, but what is critical here is that the employer did not ignore the situation in any way. The employer called in, as you would call them, the professionals for the state to do the investigation. Just didn't do the investigation itself. Relied on what they had to say in terms of a recommendation and acted on that. And actually, there wasn't a really serious consequence to Ms. Shaib other than to reprimand her and say, don't do that kind of thing. That is, you know, don't get into quarrels with your coworkers when you're complaining about them quarreling with you about your ability or competence. Don't accuse them of being incompetent or stupid. I think that's not inappropriate for both to be reprimanded in that situation. And then the record does show that after that, Van Dyne did not have any further, didn't say anything further to Ms. Shaib that was inappropriate. They don't allege that. They said that all ended after that investigation. And by the way, it was around the same time that she had complained about these other things, referring to her being the inmate coming up to her and asking her about her grooming habits, supposedly put up to that by a correctional officer. That was investigated, and the evidence was there were no further comments or actions like that after the investigation occurred, which is in about 6 or 8 months after she was originally at the facility. So we have that. And then I'd like to point out something. Mr. Darr said, he was saying, well, you know, it's pretty serious that this officer put this inmate up to asking a question. That was in the first year she worked there. The incident that occurred with the offender allegedly grabbing her buttocks was a year later. And there isn't any indication that there was anything going on involving agitation of offenders during that lengthy period of time. And that leads us to something I think that the district court judge said that is also appropriate in addition to the lack of showing of employer liability here. There's really not the showing in terms of specifics of a real hostile, pervasively hostile environment involving either sexual issues or national origin issues during the lengthy period of time that she worked there. There were essentially allegations that Van Dyne made three clearly inappropriate comments of a sexual nature towards Ms. Shaib. That stopped once that was reported. And there was, and it's not an indication that he made those kind of sexual comments or that there were national origin comments made all the time. What she really alleges is a lot of people accused her of not being very competent on a regular basis. That has nothing to do, really, with a sexually hostile environment or sexual discrimination or this national origin discrimination. There's just very little identification of those kind of comments being made. Was there more evidence that she didn't get along very well with some of her coworkers, and they made comments to her about her how they perceived her competence as a correctional officer? And yes, she did make those kind of comments. But those are something that's quite different than what's been said here. Oh, is my time up? I would ask the court to affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Darst, time, you had expired, but you may have an additional minute, Mr. Darst.
Thank you, Your Honor. Taking the last point first, when a female or any employee rejects sexual requests and then is treated by not being trained because she rejected those sexual requests, that is part of sexual harassment. And furthermore, the harassment has to be judged all together with the totality of the evidence. Judge Hamilton had asked about previous complaints of sexual harassment that she'd made, and then the reprimand of her for threatening to coworkers to file sexual harassment charges shows that she had complained orally before. Now, also in response to Judge Hamilton's requests about employer liability, this reprimand of her for threatening to make complaints of sexual harassment is the employer. And then the employer repeats that after 2010 and 2011. The employer repeats it at filing document number 78-2, page 46, where the employer reprimands her by saying, "While Captain Conyers was making copies of your documents, you claimed discrimination and acted in a disgruntled manner." And again says that they're upset that she's making complaints about discrimination instead of investigating them. And then when she tries to get out and transfer, there is no dispute that she was more qualified than the other seven applicants. That's not disputed by the state. It's not disputed by the district court. It's not disputed anywhere that she was the most qualified for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. The court of case taken under advisement.